Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Great. Well, welcome everyone to this LSE public event to mark the launch of the new book by Eric Zwick and his co-author Owen Zidar on the Everywhere Millionaire. Who is really rich in America and how they got there. So on a day of tube strikes and torrential downpours, I think some congratulations are due to everyone who's managed to make it here in person. And thanks also to all of you who are tuning in online. My name's Andy Summers. I'm director of the Center for Analysis of Taxation and faculty associate of the International Inequalities Institute here at LSE, who are kindly co-hosting tonight's event. With me on stage is our speaker and author of this fantastic new book, Eric Zwick. Eric is the Joel F. Gamunda Professor of Economics and Finance at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. His research focuses on the interaction between public policy and corporate behaviour, with a focus on taxation, fiscal stimulus, inequality, entrepreneurship, and housing policy. He's also a leading expert on income and wealth inequality in the US, an area of research that's frequently spilled over from the pages of top economics journals in which Eric's written into the mainstream news. And it's that intersection between cutting-edge use of economic data and wider perceptions about wealthy individuals that persist in the media that forms the focus of the book that Eric will be presenting to us this evening. And as a fellow tax data nerd, I love that this book takes so seriously the challenges and opportunities of using tax data to study the wealthy. But as you'll see, Eric and Owen have also collected some fascinating insights from actually speaking with individuals behind these data points, which adds, I think, an extra dimension to the analysis that Eric will share with us this evening. So I'm super excited to hear what Eric has to say about the book, and then also to hear thoughts and questions from our live audience, both in the room here and from those of you online. And before we get stuck into the main event, just need to let you know a few logistics. So this event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. We're not expecting a fire alarm, so if one occurs, please take it seriously and follow the steward's instructions. And finally, as I mentioned, there'll be a chance for audience Q&A after Eric has given his presentation. We'll aim for Eric to speak for around about 40 minutes and then to have a similar amount of time again after that for questions, and I'll explain the format for asking your questions when we get to that part of the event. So in the meantime, just remains for me to reiterate how pleased we are to have Eric here and to say over to you, Eric.
Thank you so much. I will walk around, I think, because I have a mic attached to my body that will help me give a little more dynamic. I know it's the end of the day, and I appreciate everybody coming out in the weather. This book is, I'm very excited to announce, coming out in September. So this is a bit of an early look at what's there. It's available for purchase. This goes to a billionaire's website where you can buy the book. But if you want to go to like the book website, everywheremillionaire.com, there's links to bookshop.org, which is a small independent bookstore. I'm not sure if there's a UK version of that, but we definitely encourage you to buy it wherever you prefer to buy books. And think of this as a commitment device to have it come to you on September 15th if you buy it now. But it's joined with Owen Zidar. It's definitely a story about the American economy, but I think there are a lot of lessons here for thinking about Western Europe and the rest of the developed world. And I'm looking forward to sort of seeing what resonates with the audience here and get a sense from you all about this story. So what we're trying to do in this book is unseat, I think, a very compelling narrative that lives in the conventional wisdom about wealth in America and replace it with one we think is closer in resemblance to reality. We're doing this with a two-pronged approach. And so the first prong, which I think will make the book actually quite entertaining for folks to read, who might not be used to reading a book written by two economists that's entertaining, is we have vivid stories. So the book actually opens with this wedding of the century. And these are images from the wedding, from social media. This wedding was an American bride, but they actually flew all of the guests to Paris for the wedding. They rented out Versailles for an evening, not for the wedding itself, but for like a dinner before. Here on the bottom right, you can see at the bride's sort of bachelorette jaunt the month before, the bride dressed kind of unironically like Marie Antoinette. Needless to say, this was quite an event. Adam Levine of Maroon 5 actually sung the first dance. And overall, the estimates for the cost of the wedding were about $60 million. So I want to start the audience with a question: who has $60 million to spend on their daughter's wedding? And you may be led to, I think, certain figures that play prominently in the conventional wisdom about who's really rich in America. So members of the Forbes 400 list, this journalistically collected list of billionaires, tech, finance, the Waltons from the Walmart company, and so on. We can also think about public company CEOs, Jamie Dimon from, you know, J.P. Morgan, and so on. And this view that in order to get really rich in America, you have to take this path of finance or real estate, maybe a coastal startup, a tech company. Elon, I think, is like, you know, in every story about billionaires these days or about rich people in America these days, a very important figure. Our argument is that sort of there's this much broader, vast forest of American wealth, rich private business owners collectively, that we've sort of missed by focusing on a few kind of redwoods in Silicon Valley. And, you know, we're going to make this case with vivid stories such as the wedding of the century, but also based on a decade of research using comprehensive new data that links the population of firms to their owners and employees to really sort of tell what we think is a properly representative story about the American economy that distinguishes it from other sources of data on top-end wealth. The Forbes list, public company CEOs are only for public companies. Even the Survey of Consumer Finance is conducted by the Federal Reserve only has a few hundred folks in the top 0.1% of the wealth distribution because of survey response difficulties. Very hard to run surveys of high net worth individuals. Our data is going to be quite a bit more comprehensive and descriptive than these other data sets. The central figures, the heroes and occasionally villains of the book, we call Main Street Millionaires. These are the 3 million, roughly, private business owners in America with net worth above $5 million, so that's the, you know, low end. They have average net worth of $25 million, so I think by conventional measures, these are well-off individuals. There are a lot of decamillionaires, there are a lot of centimillionaires, there are a lot of sort of light billionaires in this class. These are folks that own Main Street businesses, the typical top 0.1%er, almost all of them own a Main Street business. This kind of business, examples that maybe don't come to mind are beer distributors, car dealers, owners of an HVAC that's like heating and AC, you know, servicing businesses, also like skilled white collar businesses that have scaled some, doctors, dentists, consultants, and so on. They are very numerous. So for every large public company CEO, there are more than 1,000 private business owners, each with at least $25 million in net worth. And these are the true kind of middle rich in America, and their story is quite fascinating. And that's the story that we tell in the book. So there are three questions we're going to ask and try and answer. First is kind of descriptive. Who is really rich in America? Who are these people? And this is going to, you know, draw on tax data research that where we started, and the story about things going on in tax policy in the American economy that really made these people visible to us and to the world for the first time. I will then transition to think about where they came from, how they got rich, and then we'll also think about how they shape society. So there are a lot of policy questions that their prominence and prosperity raise that we'll try and sort of elucidate for folks to then think about, okay, what solutions to the problems they raise might we consider? This is not a policy advocacy book. I want to be quite clear. We're actually trying to say before we like propose a bunch of policies, we need to really diagnose the problems to understand society as it is. So it's really a descriptive exercise that we're doing, but we can talk about views in the Q&A, and I'm happy to share them. Okay, so the foundation is this research, administrative tax data, anonymized. Okay, so when working with the Treasury folks, where we started, we were looking at millions and millions of businesses, starting with a unique form in America where these are called pass-through businesses. They're businesses that don't pay tax at the firm level. The individual owners pay tax as the income flows through. This allows us within the tax environment to actually link folks at the top of the income distribution through to the firms they own to understand what is the type of firm, where are they located, how big are they, what industries are they in. So this descriptive work we're able to do in this data without identifying the individuals is what allows us to say, okay, the typical top 1%er is a closely held business owner of a mid-market business, 50 employees, you know, tens of millions of revenues, but because they are one of the very few owners of that business, they could be still quite wealthy by virtue of that being their source of income. Over time, we've built and supplemented this data with other sources, which I'll draw on in my talk, test score data, looking at the backgrounds of family backgrounds, sort of like, you know, rich kids versus poor kids, and like the prominence of pass-through business owners from both groups, that kind of thing. For the book, we then decided, okay, let's like de-anonymize this data in a way that's legal, which is to say not use the tax data at all, but we know what they should look like from the research we've done. Let's get some yacht and private jet registry data where you do have the individuals, and then find, you know, ones that look like the private business owners that our research, administrative research showed. We'll look at property records for high-end real estate in places like Aspen, places like Lake of the Ozarks, which is not a very famous resort community, but in the middle of America, it turns out there are a lot of $5 million homes in places like that. And you look at the owners, they're just a bunch of Main Street millionaires, like kind of mundane businesses that have generated tremendous wealth for them. Those are some examples of the data we're going to supplement. And then we conducted a number of interviews where we actually found these people and talked to them, try to tell their stories. So we're trying to put sort of faces and names to these stories to try and understand who they are, where they come from. Okay, so first, let's meet some of them. I think this is a pretty simple chart, but it's pretty powerful once you understand what it is. So what we've done here is taken the last year of the Survey of Consumer Finances. This is the Federal Reserve conducts a survey to try and estimate wealth and the portfolios of folks in the wealth distribution in the United States. The last year available is 2022 here. The Forbes 400 collectively, taking all of the Forbes billionaires and adding up their net worth, was $4 trillion. Closely held business owners with net worth above $5 million have more than 10 times as much wealth. So individually, they're not as rich as Elon, but collectively, they command far more resources. In some sense, this graph really sort of summarizes the story we're telling. It's like, if you want to understand wealth in America, and even high-end wealth, and you know who the rich are, and how much resources they command, we really need to unpack this class and figure out who they are and what's going on with them. So for every member of the Forbes 400, there are more than 4,000 private business owners with at least $10 million in net worth. So that's a lot of rich people that we have no idea who they are. Okay, how do we find them, and how do we decide to focus on them? So we ended up going to the Treasury right after graduate school, Owen and I, along with Danny Yagan, working with folks at the Treasury Department to try and help them develop models to tax private businesses in this pass-through business form that I explained before. This form had grown quite dramatically in the wake of tax reforms in the 1980s, which all of a sudden made it very advantageous to elect this form because the tax rates for individual incomes fell a lot and the corporate rate was no longer such an attractive rate to pay if you were going to operate a private business. What followed was the top 1% income share. So this is the famous Piketty and Saez series for fiscal income. The blue is the actual series going through to 2022, I believe. A huge share of this rise, more than half of it, comes from pass-through business income rising. So if you want to understand where the rise of the top 1% income share comes from, you need to understand the rise of pass-through businesses. What are the people doing that are earning the income in that form? And this was sort of the first chart that we made that kind of pointed us towards, okay, we need to understand these pass-throughs. Who are they? Law firms, car dealerships, doctors' practices? We didn't know anything about that at the time, but they drove more than half of the rise in the top 1% share, yet they had really not been explored, their role in income inequality in the U.S. what's the nature underlying this data in terms of the industry mix? So in contrast to traditional public companies, which are in the Internal Revenue Code referred to as C corporations for the subchapter of the Internal Revenue Code, according to which they're taxed, a huge share of that is in manufacturing, very capital intensive industry. And if you compare that to sort of the distribution of where workers are in the American economy, it's very disproportionately represented, manufacturing, public companies. That's when we look at sort of the stock market reports, the Wall Street Journal coverage and so on. Those are the types of companies we're much more likely to learn about. Additionally, you know, a company like Walmart or retailers, et cetera. The pass-through businesses, so that's in gold here, the millionaire-owned pass-through firms, much more broadly disseminated across the economy. There is some manufacturing for sure. There's a lot of skilled services that's less capital intensive. So these professional services ends up, you know, being slices of the economy that are not visible when we look at public companies. When we look at superstar firms, we don't learn so much about these pass-through businesses either because they're smaller, they're regional, they're in different industries. Drilling down into the types of industries we're talking about, there are some usual candidates you might not be surprised by. So lawyers are here at the very top. So these are the top 25 pass-through industries by collective top owner income. So just trying to decompose that top 1% income into the types of industries. The most recent data, which we recently updated, you know, lawyers, the number two, financial investment activity. Those would be like general partners of hedge funds, private equity funds, venture capital funds. That's the finance story. We're not saying that there aren't a lot of rich people in finance, but we're saying that they, you know, represent just a fraction and not a huge fraction of all of this broader class of wealth. Number three is one probably folks in this audience aren't that familiar with, auto dealers. It turns out auto dealers in America are incredibly rich, and there are a lot of them. These would be people who sell cars on behalf of manufacturers and service them and finance and et cetera. These are characters that we inquire several times in the book about the nature of their wealth. But then going further down, consulting, doctors, you know, oil and gas, construction, restaurants. It's a pretty broad industrial mix. You know, we have realtors here. There's some tech, computer systems design, but not too much. It's a pretty broad industrial mix, maybe a bit service intensive relative to capital intensive. The story here is there are many paths to this prosperity in the economy. Okay. One vivid example, so here's a car dealer whom we found through our yacht data. Herb Chambers is a Northeastern car dealer who specializes now in especially high-end autos. He has 59 dealerships in New England. Came from a working-class background, actually, so this is a bit of a rise-to-the-top story. He's one of more than 4,500 auto dealership owners that are worth at least $10 million in the United States. His yacht was a more than $100 million yacht called Excellence or something, or Excelsior or something like this. Another story in terms of like trying to put some richness onto this is a geographic story. So when you look at where Forbes 400 people live, it is kind of a coastal story. Like half of them live in five cities, Miami, Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York. And then all the other places. So that's actually four cities. And then we look at the mainstream millionaires and where they're distributed. Much less concentrated. There's still a lot of representation in those places, for sure. But they're much more ubiquitous across the regions of the economy. You can find them in actually most major cities. You can find them in most towns. You know, one version of this is going back to Herb Chambers. There's a car dealer in almost every town. And a lot of them are, you know, doing quite well. We actually take a road trip across America to meet some of them. Alabama, Mississippi, into Texas, looking at travel centers. This is a patent lawyer, a seamless gutter manufacturer. Some pretty funny stories, some of them. A human resources consultancy in Salt Lake. The very nice house, very pretty house. We end in Palo Alto, you know, Silicon Valley. But instead of meeting like a tech founder, we meet somebody who manufactured frozen quiches and sold her business to a private equity firm, I think, for $30, $40 million, something like that. Move slow and make things. That's sort of the alternative path that that Nancy Mueller illustrates in that story. Okay, and so I think I've sort of emphasized this. The typical top earner we end up seeing is this owner, operator of a single closely held firm, mid-market in size, 30 employees, you know, $25 million of annual revenue worth maybe $25 to $50 million, actively participating in their firm. In terms of the demographics, you know, white male, late middle age, college graduate, usually married, but there's a lot of diversity, a lot of heterogeneity in this population as well. Okay, so that's seeing who they are. Now let's think about where they come from. This is going to be a little bit for the folks who aspire to get rich. There may be some in the audience, or you know, hopefully among those who buy books. I would not recommend writing a book as a way to get rich. But you know, part of it is sort of trying to understand, well, you know, for the successful entrepreneurs in the data, what are the factors that really sort of promote their entrepreneurship? And here we're drawing on this vast administrative research, data research we've been working on for almost a decade, in collaboration with folks here at the LSE, John Van Rienen, who's very, I'm very happy to see in the audience. But we also tell some stories of some of these figures. This gentleman here, very suavely dressed, is Dick Portillo. Behind him is a picture of the first hot dog stand he opened, which had no running water, and so they actually had to take dishes back home every night to wash in the bathtub, where they developed a mustard stain in the bathtub at home from that phase of the business's growth. Over time, he grew it into 75 locations across the Midwest and Sun Belt and sold the company for $1 billion in 2014. We found him in the yacht data. His yacht is called Top Dog. He used no debt to build this business, no venture capital, no outside equity at all. Just plowed the money back in as profits came in, reinvesting to grow it over that time period. When he sold the company, he actually still owned a bunch of the real estate, renting it back to the private equity investor. So there are a lot of folks like Dick Portillo who grew up actually in a housing project in Chicago. So from you know immigrant parents, very low income beginning. If we zoom out and think about broader data on where founders come from, including those that end up to grow into large businesses, it is the case that there are more founders, including of star businesses, from the middle class. My understanding is in the UK, the middle class goes up to the 99th percentile, which is an interesting observation. I guess Owen and I disagree, actually. He doesn't even think that this should be the middle class, the P66 to P90. But there's you know a lot more from these groups than from the top 1%, which is not to say that there's an equal opportunity to become a successful entrepreneur independent of where you're born. If we look at the propensity to be a founder based on where you're born, rich kids you know, are nearly an order of magnitude more likely to be founders than poor kids. And the question you know, we try and inquire is, like, is that because of access to financial resources or because of access to opportunities to learn things, to take risks? What's going on with those background environments that promotes folks into entrepreneurship? One thing that isn't driving that, but we can say from the rich administrative data, is specific scholastic aptitude. So if we look at folks who score at different levels of the standardized test scores that go into college in the US, the SAT, we look at income at age 35. There's an increasing relationship that then turns quite steeply positive in the top decile. It seems like you need to, you know, it helps to be quite academically successful if you want to earn a lot of income at age 35. If you want to be an inventor, so to sort of do some scientific innovation, it's even steeper, the relationship with standardized test scores, which kind of makes sense if you think about the dependence on inventing on science and math, especially. If you want to be a star founder, it's almost flat. There's an increasing relationship, but you know, one way of putting this is like you don't have to be a rocket scientist to start and grow a successful hot dog business, right? There's quite a bit more democratic access to this path, based on scholastic aptitude at least. There are other factors that seem to be quite relevant for these successful entrepreneurs, which I think is a quite interesting and compelling finding. Another question you might be asking is like, well, we are selecting success stories, right? We're looking at the top 1%, the folks who made it. But of course, a lot of people start a business and it fails, and what happens to them? So in our research, one thing we're able to do is sort of track folks who start businesses. So that's what I'm showing here in green. And compare them to very similar workers with similar incomes, industry and where they were working before founding a business, and just track them over the subsequent decade. And here we can see that this is on average, the entrepreneurs versus the matched workers, they do about 10% better per year in terms of their income, not including the sort of the growth, compounding growth of the value of the business that they started. The median slightly outperforms the similar matched worker. There is an increased likelihood of, say, losing money on in the left tail. There's no question about that. There's a much greater increased likelihood of being in the right tail of the earnings distribution. So in some sense, entrepreneurship pays even at the sort of at the median and average here. This includes all the failures, this data. So if the business fails, you re-enter the labor market, maybe you start something again. So it's risky, but I don't want to overstate how risky it is. Okay. So that's kind of the, you know, aspirational rise to the top, lots of options component of it. There's maybe like a more nuanced or darker vision of like where the entrepreneurial income comes from, which is to think about as the pie grows, as these businesses grow, are they sharing it with workers or grabbing bigger slices for themselves? And so we've tried to decompose the growth in ownership pay into components going to workers. We can see a non-trivial chunk of the growing profits is coming from a smaller share going to workers, a smaller labor share, a higher share going to owners. And even within this, sort of a smaller share going to the component of owner payments that are taxable. So there's an increasing role for tax policy to also allocate income towards the owners relative to the government. Another way to test this that Owen's done in some related research is to look at firms that receive patents. What happens to the surplus that's created by those patents? How is it shared between workers and owners? And it seems like owners are able to capture, you know, the vast majority of those additional profits and gains. So there's a lot of negotiating power for these owners, perhaps reflecting their specific position, their unique assets they bring to the table, the relative weakness of the laborers' bargaining power in these types of firms. And these are some aspects about sort of the slicing and the sharing between owners and workers that we try and inquire into the work. So like a component of this growing profit share is falling labor share for these firms that we want to try and understand. Okay, now it's nice to start a firm and grow rich coming from a poor background, but you know, the easiest way to get rich is to be born rich. I recommend it if you can figure out how to do so. We spend some time on what we call the shortcut, which is to sort of inherit a family business or to be born as a child of one of these Main Street millionaires. There's not amazing data on this. We try and back it out in different ways using even our administrative data to think about what fraction of the folks at the top that are closely held business owners have done so through founding businesses of their own versus inheriting. So founding and acquiring an existing business versus inheriting is much more common, but you know, a quarter to maybe even 30% are inherited family businesses. So we spent some time profiling these to try and understand what it looks like when things go well and the transition goes well, what it looks like when it's hard to find a successor, you know, among your children, kind of the King Lear story, but you know, with actual stories of people where it's not naturally the case that you can, you know, find somebody to take over the business. And you know, what happens then to the business is private equity takes over. And so private equity has emerged in the U.S. as a natural successor to a lot of these businesses when there's no natural heir. So here on the left is Warren Buffett's protege, who actually left Berkshire to start a private equity business that focuses on acquiring mid-market businesses like manufacturers of boat covers. On the right is a story in the Financial Times titled Harvard Burger School, which has emphasized sort of the increasing prominence of fast food franchising as a path for folks after getting a prestigious MBA. They then go and run a series of Burger King franchises in sort of like a coastal North Carolina. And so MBA-trained operators have increasingly, you know, moved in. Basically, the growth of Main Street millionaires in the U.S. has actually transformed finance in a way, attracting talent and capital from private equity increasingly into this slice of the economy. When capital floods that way, this is a nice way that, you know, these Main Street millionaires cash out, and that's when their consumption often turns up. Okay, so for the last part of the talk, let me talk about how these folks shape society in subtle ways that have been underappreciated. So one way is through what we call stealthy politics. So we've called these folks the stealthy wealthy because they fly under the radar. We encountered them in the political process as we were following the 2017 tax reform debate in the United States. This chart shows the wealth distribution for the general population in comparison to disclosed net worths of members of Congress. This is the federal legislative body in the US. The average net worth for folks in the Senate was $10 million or $7 million in the House. There are many private business owners in this population. A quarter of the tax writing representatives recently were business owners, pest control, auto dealer, construction, three auto dealers here. It's remarkable. There are not a lot of auto dealers in the population, but there are three on the tax writing committee that has like 40 members. It's like 10% of the tax writing committee. Here's a franchise owner, Kevin Hearn, or he's known as Kevin McCongressman. Nick Carnes, I think, has this nice quote, "Would you like to be represented by millionaire lawyer, millionaire businessman?" So there's a conventional view of money in politics in the U.S. that like a lot of it comes through lobbying. I think sort of surprising fact is that a lot of folks actually, the business owners themselves become politicians. And it's not to say that they only write policy to benefit themselves, but it becomes less surprising when policy emerges that seems to benefit business where the votes came from. But it's not just at the federal level that this shows up. If we look at representation in city halls, 85% of mayoral positions, so these are mayors of cities and towns, are part-time. It's a lot easier to have a flexible job, so you can do that part-time mayor position if you run a business. 30 to 40% of these mayors are business owners or executive. What are the political leanings? So the recent study tried to use data from the Paycheck Protection Program to create a sampling frame to find these business owners and ask them about their political views. They are a bit more Republican. They're much more likely to report being independent than when asked sort of like, are you R or D? They're more likely to be Republican. So about 10 percentage points more likely. But there are a lot of Democrats here too. And I think, you know, recognizing this bipartisan nature of the rise of these Main Street millionaires and their, you know, role in politics can also help explain the tilt of policy and its endurance and, you know, resistance to reform independent of who's, say, you know, in the White House or independent of who's in charge of Congress. There's a lot of representation on both sides. Now, of course, there is also the money in politics version of the story where they're donors. So in the 2024 election, which folks on this side of the ocean may have also followed, the first biggest donor was Elon Musk. And that's been very well covered. The second business donor were founders of a shipping and packaging materials company in Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin, called the U-Lines. And they spent tens of millions of dollars just behind Elon in terms of their aggregate spending. Much more under the radar, for sure. State-level lobbying, there's some data on this. So it's not just at the federal policy, because so many of these businesses operate in local markets where local regulation is actually more important for the effectiveness of these businesses. We look at the distribution of lobbying, like what types of industries the money comes from. It looks a lot like the distribution of sort of top pass-through profits. There's a high correlation. These businesses are, you know, independently not as large as sort of like a Fortune 500 company. But when they form into a consortium of the National Association of Auto Dealers, the beer distributors, and so on, they can lobby with considerable clout. One example, this is John McCain, a former senator from Arizona who was a Republican nominee for president. He was a war veteran, and his maverick reputation is sort of well known as sort of, you know, part of his political story. Part of his political story that's less well known is that a lot of the financing for his early campaigns, his continuing campaigns, come from his wife's family, who are beer distributors based out in Arizona. It turns out to be a beer distributor is a license to get extremely rich by controlling the ability of manufacturers of beer to sell to restaurants or bars and so on. And it's very hard to cancel those contracts in a lot of states because of state laws that they've lobbied over time to get put into place. And these beer distributors have basically generated protections in almost all states for their business. They managed to beat PepsiCo's attempt to circumvent them when trying to sell a hard version of Mountain Dew back in the day. They're the third largest political action committee spender in 2022 and very, very underappreciated. But there are a lot of pass-through beer distributors in our data, and I think it's interesting to think about this local market power story for certain industries where entry is effectively blocked or heavily regulated. These are industries where we do see a lot of these Main Street millionaires emerge. Another example would be in the auto dealers, as we've talked about. All 50 states have franchise laws that basically make it impossible for manufacturers to cancel a contract with a dealer without paying them a lot to cancel that contract. 17 states ban direct sales. So when Tesla tried to sell, they were kind of blocked from doing so in many states. Recently, Volkswagen was trying to sell directly under a new brand, and the dealers have been fighting back. In the auto bankruptcy and bailout, they managed to, even as the entire auto industry was at risk, verge of failure, to fight back consolidation attempts that would have made it a little bit more efficient. The auto dealers were quite powerful in that. And then the center here, and in the skilled services, this is quite an important story in America. Professional licensing guilds across many industries either restrict entry into these skilled services. So think about the number of doctors, the number of dentists, or what dentists can do versus what hygienists can do. So dentists in a lot of states have been able to prevent hygienists from doing teeth whitening. So it's a way of protecting their turf. And then realtors. So in the US, we have this realtor industry where the contract structure and control to the listing operation basically creates protection for realtors to charge quite high fees on transfers that are quite high by sort of international standards. So this is an interesting contrast to kind of the market power by large multinationals story that I think is much more prevalent in the news, because geographic dispersion is creating a kind of political leverage. Because they're all kind of all over. There's a car dealer in every town. They employ a lot of people in every town. They pay a lot of sales tax at the local level. And through these mechanisms, they can command a lot of power that kind of flies under the radar. Okay, this is a bit of a joke, but this is me, Danny, and Owen wearing our S Corporation t-shirts at Danny's wedding, actually. One of the ways we came upon the power of the Main Street millionaires was in this 2017 tax reform debate, where we, were sort of working with folks at the Treasury to develop these new models that then we thought could inform tax policy design. And once we know what the right tax policy is, right, it'll just happen, right, because the policymakers will do it. So the naivete, right, that's the B story, is the coming of age element of this book. We are characters in the book, and you can pity us or whatever you like to do when reading that story. The history of personal tax policy over the 60 years has been one that has bent in the direction of these closely held private businesses in a lot of ways. So top personal income tax rates have come down quite dramatically over time. And in addition, capital gains rates have come down further, so if you want to sell your business. And the estate tax has been eroded considerably over time as well. So if you want to transfer your business to next of kin, for a private business, it's especially attractive because of valuation rules that make it relatively easy to transfer large fractions of the business at relatively low price to avoid the estate tax. One example that's quite salient from the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, this is Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, who held out his vote for a while to get a reduced rate for pass-through businesses, including Mr. Johnson's family-run plastics manufacturing business, This quote is quite evocative. I just have in my heart a real affinity for these owner-operated pass-throughs. We need to make American businesses competitive. They're not right now, but in making businesses competitive, we can't leave behind the pass-throughs. So tugging on those heartstrings, just like his passion for pass-throughs. So this 199A deduction, sort of like a targeted pass-through income tax cut, cost $400 billion over 10 years. In blue states, there were pass-through business tax cuts that basically allowed folks to get around a cap on state and local tax deductions. And then these estate tax exemptions have become much more generous over the last 25, 30 years. All benefit kind of these closely held businesses quite dramatically. In the Paycheck Protection Program, we had the most generous small business support program during the pandemic, which gave, in some sense, unconditional forgivable loans to like businesses up to $10 million for several months. I think 30 members of Congress reportedly received PPP loans. These are some of the car dealers who received them, including Roger Williams is a character from Texas, whom we profile a little bit in the book. And then most recently, in the One Big Beautiful Bill, which you know has a very self-descriptive name, this deduction for pass-throughs was made permanent at a cost of $740 billion over 10 years. The salt cap workarounds were preserved. The estate tax exemption was further increased to $30 million. So you can pass $30 million now to heirs tax-free, which is quite dramatic. And a special deduction for new car auto loan interest for 4 years. So in that 2017 reform, we learned about the power of the auto dealers in writing tax policy because there was a cap on how much you could deduct of interest in the corporate tax bill, but then there was a carve-out just for floor plan financing for dealerships. And that's where we sort of started to recognize there's something going on here with these folks. Tax policy isn't just being written with the interest of making the most efficient tax system. And the book closes actually a bit where we learn about Mike Johnson, who's the current Speaker of the House, who rents his D.C. residence from a car dealer scion. So that's the story of the book. One way to think about what we're saying is that, you know, a lot of news stories have made the case that this is the next Gilded Age, or the Gilded Age has returned. And we think that's not quite correct, because this is more of an age of mass affluence, which we call the age of millionaires. This hidden class of business owners that prevail at the top with diverse backgrounds from diverse industries and geographies, who, you know, individually are not as wealthy as Elon, but collectively command far more resources and have like very significant influence on public policy and on society around us in ways that you can recognize once you know to look for them, but they're kind of flying under the radar. Some build from scratch. They seem to rely more on experience, and sort of like that grind is an important part of the story, say for somebody like Dick Portillo. Others inherit or acquire existing businesses. And as I've mentioned, they're surprisingly powerful. So I'm really appreciative of your attention and time, looking forward to questions. And yeah, you should no longer be surprised to learn that the wedding of the century was a third generation car dealer from Coral Gables who sold their business for several hundred million dollars in a roll up and decided to spend a big chunk of it on their daughter's wedding in Paris. So thank you so much.
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thank you, Eric. That was a fascinating tour based on such amazing data and coupled with those striking anecdotes. We've got time for quite a few questions, I think. So if you're here in the audience or online, start mulling over questions that you might like to ask. In the meantime, I'm going to just abuse my position as chair to ask a couple of things that struck me from that talk. So one is the question about sort of why the media portrayal is so different from the from what you can reveal from these data sources, and in particular, the puzzle that struck me looking at this is what you're painting is a picture of sort of local businesses, actually mostly consumer-facing kind of industries, or at least not all business-to-business. These aren't kind of hidden businesses in that sense. And so you might think that people would be quite in touch with the existence of these businesses. So where's is the misperception coming from just how profitable they are, or is there some other kind of misdirection that's going on in terms of what the media focuses on, perhaps because the public data sources are quite concentrated at the very, very top of the wealth distribution? So I'd be interested in thoughts on what kind of has led to this misdiagnosis. And second kind of related question on measurement is just what you think could be missing from the data that you have. So you're obviously starting with a population of business owners or kind of active business owners. Should we think about there being an important sort of subset of wealthy Americans that aren't active business owners? So, you know, landed wealth, passive holdings of shares in you know, perhaps listed companies and so on. So yeah, interested in thoughts on what might be missing from the albeit very wide-ranging picture that you've painted already.
Yeah, awesome. So on the media question, I think it's a bit of a looking under the lamppost diagnosis, which is to say what is easy to see are the listed companies, the public companies, which are not representative of the American economy. The tech billionaires, especially those that seek public attention, which is a subset of them. Forbes covers, because Forbes can find them. Forbes cannot find the like $300 million mid-market, even B2B business that doesn't want to be found, of which there are just many because of the size of the economy. In addition, you know, the journalists, business journalists are doing their best. They do concentrate in a few media markets. You know, New York Times is in New York, Wall Street Journal is in New York, Washington Post is in DC. There's some stuff in the West Coast, but there's much less just coverage. There's just much less access to a big chunk of the population, the economic activity. So you're just not seeing it that way. A lot of the stories I told here, there's a consumer-facing element to them, and I do think that's an important part of it, in part just because of how big those markets are. But there is there's a bit of a twist where you don't see them because, say, the beer distributor doesn't put the beer distributor company's name on the side of the truck. What's on the side of the truck is Budweiser. Where the beer distributor's name shows up is like on the door in a little decal that says Reyes Distribution. The franchise, the McDonald's franchise, says McDonald's on the front, but it's somebody who owns 15 McDonald's that then licenses the McDonald's franchise. That's the owner. And so I was talking to somebody who's like the general counsel of McDonald's who had retired, who said, yeah, our shareholders and the owners, McDonald's, they did quite well. The founder, you know, did extremely well. The franchisers are richer than us, and the distributors are even richer than them. So it's the guys who sell the cheese and the buns and the plastic bag liners and the napkins and stuff that turn out they're able to just like, you know, capture a huge chunk of that business and do extremely well. And those are harder to find unless you start thinking about the supply chain and start thinking about like, oh, who sells buns to McDonald's? And it turns out there's like some bakery based in, you know, Baltimore or something like that that ends up doing a lot of it. That kind of thing. So you start figuring out ways to find them that they're not immediately obvious. There are a lot of business-to-business ones also, and they can be harder to find for different reasons. We do cover a bunch of them in the manufacturing sector especially. On your last question about active versus passive, to the extent that if you look at top income statistics, where top 1% income, top 0.1% income comes from, it's not interest or rents. So maybe they have a bunch of land, but it's not generating any income. I think that's just not the right story for the modern economy when thinking about wealth. There are the multi-generational families, for sure. You know, the Waltons for Walmart, the Mars family for the Mars Corporation, these kinds of things. And those are very rich families, mostly not involved in the business, that are passive beneficiaries of the business. So there's only some of that. But if we looked at, you know, the statistics that we have on inherited versus founded, this first generation seems to be quite large. So sort of interesting to recognize how much dynamism there still appears to be.
Great, thanks. So we have some time for questions from both the live audience here in the room and online. I'm going to try and collect a bit of both over a few rounds of questions. I'll take maybe two or three per round. So I've got some hands up already here. I'll take this gentleman in the front row first. Mic is making its way to you. Yeah, if you and also if you could everyone start, if you're comfortable with this, please just briefly introducing you know, who you are and your affiliation, if you have one.
Thank you so much. My name is Richard. I was a graduate student here many moons ago. I've loved your presentation, so thank you again. A couple of quick questions, but have you at all looked at data outside the US, or was this endeavor more than enough for you? Secondly, whilst it, of course, it's fascinating, of course, it is the story of America. You know, America was the land where people could come and run businesses. As an economist, do you have an insight or an analysis or a perspective as to how this wealth was scaled? Is there something about America? I have a view on that, but I'm interested in your thoughts. Thank you very much.
Great. And question here from the gentleman in the blue jumper.
Hello, my name's Justin Kopeck. I'm a master's student in economics here at the LSE. And thanks for being here with us tonight. Really enjoyed the presentation. My question for you is, I was really curious about how much you were able to find about the differentiation in where wealth is stored amongst these Main Street millionaires, especially towards the lower threshold, as opposed to, say, the Forbes 400 types and the billionaires. How much more does it end up in places like housing in terms of a primary residence versus secondary residences, stocks versus in the businesses themselves? Curious what you were able to find with respect to that. Thank you.
And a question just in the third row here.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for the presentation and sharing such interesting data. My name's Ed Butcher. I'm a private citizen, just interested here as a member of the public with no affiliation. I was interested in any analysis that you undertook with the impact on growth. So you sort of talk about these people, but what's their impact on the American economy, and what would happen if they didn't exist? Where do they sit in the sort of rich fauna of the American economy? And a few times you sort of euphemistically refer to efficient taxation, but I was wondering whether you're able to kind of say what that might look like, and you know, what the impact is of taxation on the existence of these people, and you know, whether greater or less taxation would have an impact.
Okay, great. I think we'll take that
cool
set of three to begin with.
That's great. So, yeah, the global question versus, you know, the U.S. story. This seemed like a big enough topic, and we're taking advantage. We're trying to also stick to the data and try and use that as a foundation to make sure we don't say things that we don't have support. But we have some observations. There have been attempts following our research and, you know, in coincidence, to sort of look at other countries where you can start to link through from, you know, individuals at the top of the income wealth distribution to, like,
the businesses they own to see to what extent our folks at the top in the UK, in Scandinavia, in France, also private business owners. And I would have to say my first blush reading of that is that it's like quite common in a lot of these countries as well. An important distinction is it doesn't show up in income statistics the way it does in the US because of this taxation difference. So in the US where there's a pass-through tax, it shows up on the individual's income tax return as profits. In most Western countries, there's still the preference for leaving the income to accrue and earn within the corporation. It doesn't show up. It gets paid as dividends occasionally. There's pretty generous bequest rules. There's life insurance. There are other games for moving it across generations, meaning that like the income tax statistics, the inequality that is based on that don't really show the private businesses in the same way we see in the U.S. But I feel like the difference between the U.S. and a lot of these other countries is smaller than maybe a lot of our priors. And I think it's an exciting area for continued research, is to try and bring these data online in other countries. I'm not like an American exceptionalist. I think people want to get rich in a lot of these countries and have strategies to do so. There are different rules. And so I do wonder whether, you know, differences in how we regulate mid-market firms versus small firms do change the incentive to grow within the private sector versus sell to a large company earlier on. Pension systems that have less capital allocated to private alternatives because of the structure of the pension system means these exit opportunities for these closely held businesses are like much less available or less lucrative in a lot of Western Europe than they are in the US. Private equity is just is present, but like I think less prominent. It's an interesting exit valve. So I think there are some differences. I mean, where did that growth come from? You know, some of these folks benefited greatly from globalization and sort of also cross-state deregulation that basically made their markets a little bit bigger. Some of these folks, like the auto dealers, benefited from just having captured a local market. Not they're not being entry, but just the economy getting bigger and bigger and bigger and demand for that product growing with the economy, and they're just capturing a slice of it. So they're incumbents. I don't think that's great for growth. I don't think that's great for consumers. So I think what's interesting about this story is there is some nuance where, like, you have competitive industries like restaurants, food service, a lot of entry, maybe not massive innovation, but incremental innovation, like making a better fried chicken sandwich than the incumbent. But then you have these, like, car dealers where I feel like it's, you know, there's a competitive question there that's really important to address. And so some of that wealth comes from, you know, the pockets of consumers. The portfolios of the merely rich. So, you know, we set our threshold a bit low, above 5 million, but that's still high enough that most of those folks are not primarily housing or pension rich. And so the average net worth is 25 million. I think what's striking is, like, unless they've sold the business, which meant most of them haven't, their wealth is really concentrated in this, you know, undiversified asset that throws off a lot of profits, but they can't access a huge chunk of it to consume. And their portfolios look quite exposed to that asset for a big chunk of, you know, the life cycle of the firm and for them. For growth, I talked a little bit about this in terms of, you know, there's incremental innovation, there's more transformative innovation, but I don't see a lot of the more transformative innovation in this class. I think it's interesting to think that you could find niches and gaps and market opportunities in growth areas where you're not being super innovative, but maybe taking some existing skill set and applying it diligently to establish a business, grow it, build a customer list, kind of do kind of boring stuff. Like there's some guy I talked to that basically they sell carpet refurbishment services to schools. So schools need to redo their carpets pretty often because, you know, schools are dirty and, you know, because kids have fun. And the business of basically, you know, redoing those carpets is like a pretty stable business. That's like not a huge business, but it's you're the guy who does it. You get referrals and you just keep doing it, I guess. Someone figured out that that was a business to do. Now, I think in the industries where there's more of a market capture story or like a local market power story, that's not contributing to productivity growth. That's profits without a ton of productivity growth, and that's like a problem, I think, for regulation to think about. And then on tax, what would an efficient tax system do? I'm not sure the case for giving these businesses' tax preference relative to the traditional personal income, labor income tax rate makes a lot of sense in terms of, like, if you give them that tax preference, do they really grow? Do they really invest? Do they really hire more? The evidence suggests not so much, and you create strong incentives to relabel labor income as profits, which I think just is like creates a system of unfairness in the tax code overall, and leakage that, you know, sort of undermines the system, I think is important to revisit. So I'm, you know, quite focused on kind of harmonizing the labor and capital income tax rates. You know, we cut the tax rates for large multinationals because of cross-border international competition. But to like cut the tax rate for the car dealer because we cut the tax rate for like the large multinational pharmaceutical company seems like maybe we could be more creative.
Take another round of questions now and start first of all with a question from the online audience, which I think Andrew is going to read out for us.
Yeah, so one of the ones online is people tend to accept inequality more when they see it as earned rather than inherited or extracted. So does the image of the mainstream millionaires that you're portraying as kind of, you know, more relatable, self-made, legitimate wealth creators make redistribution politically more challenging?
And some, two more questions from the room. I'm going to give priority to the people who were left over from the last round. So the lady in the purple jumper.
Hello, my name is Marta, I'm LSE alumni. Thank you for the interesting talk. So I understand that the millionaires that you measured all together have like more income than the 400 richest, but are these millionaires like connected enough for them to have real power? Like if every of them has just like a small chunk of power, then how is that power like considerably enough more than, for example, what Elon Musk has?
And the gentleman in the white T-shirt toward the back there.
Hi, thanks for your time. I've heard about your book on Bloomberg, so good advertising. Two types of questions. I'll try and make them clear. The first one is, and it's kind of like two questions in one, how far back does your data go in terms of range? I might have missed that at the beginning. And I wanted to know, like a derivative question of that is, you know, now we're very much in a digital world. Are there any interesting trends you've seen in segments that are not selling physical products, even if it's B2C? And are there any interesting tax, I won't say loopholes, but is there any interesting tax considerations with people that are crypto millionaires and content makers and stuff like that? That's the first thing. And the second question is, does wealth management organizations and private equity, do they make trying to access data for millionaires more difficult because maybe businesses are being acquired more by these, well, maybe not wealth management, but maybe more private equity. Are they acquiring businesses much earlier, which is making it difficult for you to get good, rich analysis on data? So that's the two types of questions.
Thank you.
Cool. So a lot of awesome questions. Okay, so... earned versus inherited and preferences for redistribution. So I think we are grappling with how much redistribution should we have and how should we implement it. And I think it's like it's a really challenging political moment where we see wealth inequality high and rising, income inequality high and rising. Understanding the nature tells you about both, like, do we think it was just or unjust the way that they got there? And also tells you about what do we think of the consequences of increasing the tax on them such that we could promote redistribution. I'm not a political philosopher, but on the question of, like, looking at what they're doing and, you know, whether we could sustain taxing them more, my view is that, like, the evidence here suggests that they can afford to pay more tax and it wouldn't necessarily change their behavior all that much. Finding so many of these like more mundane billionaires in the data on yacht and jet registrations and like $5 million houses across the country suggests to me like there's plenty of consumption that they can afford a little extra tax also. Were we to even roll back our tax code to like where it was in the late 90s, we could close probably half of the deficit without having a very, very dramatically different tax system. We have a structural deficit in the U.S. about 7% of GDP at close to full employment. Taxing the billionaires will do a little bit, but it's not sufficient, I think. Just the numbers aren't quite there, unless, very high tax rates. Maybe you could get close, but more incremental taxes on a lot of these folks. Whether they earned or inherited, seems like they can afford to pay. And as we've shown, some look like there's more of an earned story. Some look like there's more of an inherited story. Some looks like there's more of a market cap power story. There's a lot of nuance there. But ultimately, are we going to hurt the economy by incrementally increasing their taxes? How much can we raise? I think the answer is pretty clear on that one. Elon versus the army of ants. Sometimes we call them the middlegarks. So they're sort of like the oligarchs, but they're in the Middle Earth, like Tolkien. One colorful story from this most recent OB3 tax debate that renewed the personal income taxes. That legislation occurred at a time when Elon had just had his adventure in the government with Doge. The clean energy, the tax credits for clean vehicles went away. The car dealers got the deduction for auto loan interest. There was a new tax break, plus the made permanent income tax preference that benefited them. I think that's evidence that there's quite a lot of power, even if it's distributed, that's operating there as a countervailing force to the small number of the tech billionaires who clearly have a lot of power as well. And I'm not arguing against that. I think it's more that the narrative seems to basically have only focused on that. That's a pretty recent phenomenon where they've really aligned with, one party. But I think the story of rising inequality, of change trends in the American economy, it's a much longer story. And so I don't think the timing quite works either if we want to understand where it's coming from. How far back does our data go? So we really do trace the rise of pass-throughs back to this 1980s reform that really changed and flipped the rules. And there are a lot of economic trends that are also helping. So first, that just creates the data. Almost the paper trail lets us see them for the first time, which is cool. The reduced tax rate allowed them to get more after-tax profits and maybe reinvest that and build up in sort of a cumulative fashion. But you also have these trends that are headwinds, globalization, declining interest rates that just make those businesses more valuable. You have some deregulation across states that allow them to go across markets and expand their footprint a bit. And those forces, I think, are helping them grow at the margin. In healthcare, you have just this growing demand for health services and curtailed supply, which in the U.S. is quite uniquely concentrating profits in, there's providers, there's hospitals, there's drug companies, so on. Our healthcare system is a whole separate topic. But they show up here in a little bit in the corner. It's quite interesting. The digital world, right, we're intentionally kind of saying, look, tech is cool, love it, AI, fascinating, but let's not chase all the shiny objects. Let's also think about some less shiny objects that are nevertheless ubiquitous and quite important. One observation on AI that I think is kind of fun, it really has reduced the cost of starting a business, the sort of boring business planning stuff. And so I think there's a lot of ways to be an entrepreneur. You still have to figure out an idea, and you also have to think about the competitive environment in which everybody's doing the same thing. So what's your moat? What's your defense? And usually these folks that are successful, they worked for a while in some kind of unglamorous sector and then sort of figured out here's an opportunity to maybe go a step further and take some risk, start a business, take advantage of that. But I'm kind of excited about the prospects of AI to disrupt a lot of, especially these skilled service businesses. They're charging really high prices for services that seem to be able to be done, at least some of them, with the help of the AIs. Crypto and content creators, don't have much to say about them. I'm not sure how many there are. I'm open to learning. This is a really digital, tactile, blue-collar kind of, contrarian view of the economy that maybe it's just going to be obviously wrong in a decade, but we're at least taking a stand. And then on private equity, I think the private equity story is kind of fun because folks are going to glamorous business schools in order to run plumbing businesses. And that's a funny story, or to run a fast casual, Outback Steakhouse kind of restaurant. And that's just a quite funny story, about how there's just a lot of surplus there to be captured, and private equity is like finding the niche where there's a willing seller, which is a big problem for them often, is to like find a target that's willing to sell. Portillo was only willing to sell because he was in his early 80s, and even then it was like kind of hard to convince him to sell. He really didn't want to sell, and he immediately regretted it because he thinks they screwed up the business after he sold it. So it's just like the guy's just obsessed with running these restaurants.
Okay, I think we've got time for one or possibly two more rounds of questions, but do get your hand up and your question in if you can in this round. We'll take one more from online and then two from the audience.
Yeah, so online, someone has asked, the number of publicly listed companies in the US has decreased by about 50% from the mid-1990s to today. Does your research offer any insight as to why that is? Is it due to the rise of private equity?
And question from the person in the black blazer toward the back there.
Thank you for your talk today. My name is Caden. I'm a year 12 student at Dartford Grammar School. And my question is, for your own research on like, the invisible millionaire business owners, like how do you observe the localized market and political power of these mainstream millionaires comparing to like the superstar firm narrative of the Forbes 400? And like, what do you think has the greater impact on America today, like the mid-market or the globalized firm?
And question from the gentleman in the checked shirt here.
Yeah, thank you for the talk. That was really, really good. I'd like to ask about diversity and whether the data you've got allows you to talk a little bit about in two aspects. One is the international aspect. Are you seeing people coming to the US and the sort of American dream of setting up their business and becoming very successful? Are you seeing tax driving people out of the US and going overseas? And the argument in the UK about taxing the wealthy more is often at the moment around, well, if you tax the wealthy more, they'll go and live somewhere else and we won't get any of their money. So we need to keep our tax rates competitive so they stay here and pay taxes here. And the other is the within the cohort you have, you said the typical person was a white, middle-aged man, married, et cetera. Is that, how typical is that, and what diversity do you see? I mean, is that kind of a stereotype? And do you see, how wide is the distribution of age and ethnicity and gender and so on? Because you've got quite a big cohort. Was it a million or so people? So you must see quite a lot of diversity in there.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
The fallen public companies, I think that, in the U.S., like, rising private capital markets has played a pretty important role in basically extending the runway for companies to stay private. And you sort of see the valuation at which companies go public. It's a cashing out. In the recent set, maybe because there's just such frothy valuation for AI-related businesses, it's like, you want to issue equity when the price is really, really attractive. They're able to raise tons and tons of money before then. And, maybe private equity, more the mid-market buyouts, has also played some role in, we've seen growth, endowments, pensions, and so on, allocating there, for sure. It's still a few thousand companies, plus or minus, very manufacturing-oriented, very, like, multinational-oriented, important for economic activity and multinational and global activity. But I think what's interesting about all these folks is they're kind of just like operating in an economy, just like at another plane. The evolution of private capital markets is sort of happening in the background, but not necessarily affecting them in the same way as it's affecting, say, the VC-backed startup, which is just like a really small sliver of this broader economy. Global firm market power versus the mid-market. Yeah, I think Amazon commands some power in web services specifically. In retail, it's complicated. I view that as complicated because it's like generating a ton of consumer surplus at the same time by providing like same-day shipping or whatever. The treatment of workers is a problem. And so there's like market power and labor markets there. Interesting thing that we sort of spent some time on is labor market protections that seem to also affect these franchise businesses that are not owned by like large multinational companies where you see non-competes. and other things for like sandwich artists at Jimmy John's or franchise, you know, businesses. And, you know, like there's a role for minimum wage to help workers at these mid-market businesses, not just sort of the Amazon workers. And so I think, you know, what's going on in the labor market that these firms have access to, I think healthcare, access to healthcare services is an important problem in the U.S., where getting access to healthcare is something that forces people to work for big companies versus small companies. And so they're like, there's some really interesting dynamics where I think power is not the same story for like the Amazons versus the mid-market retailer. The car dealers have demonstrated tremendous market power vis-a-vis the manufacturers, and it's quite telling to see that. And they've like used lobbying at the state level, and the fact that they are geographically decentralized to get these local regulations and protections. You know, the manufacturers are very geographically concentrated. So that's a story that we don't hear that much when we think about market power or antitrust. I think that's an important one. So then diversity, yes. So two dimensions of this. International, yes, immigrants are disproportionately entrepreneurial. There's like definitely an important component of the immigrant story there that's like quite, you know, it's an vision of the American dream that's like kind of inspiring, right? And it's nice to have a little bit of data that suggests that it's not completely gone. Because there is like a lot of fear the American dream is dead. We're saying, well, like, you know, maybe it's a little bit weaker than it was before, but there's still a lot of opportunity there. We tell one story about a guy who came to the U.S. as an immigrant named Shahid Khan, went to University of Illinois, so like a state university in engineering. Then he went and worked for like an auto parts supplier. Then he started like manufacturing bumpers. And then he ends up like being like the number one distributor of bumpers into auto manufacturers. And he bought the Jacksonville Jaguars. So he owns like a sports team. He's like quite rich and has a great mustache. And so, you know, like that's like an immigrant story. There are more recent ones as well in the AI, you know, like startups. There's some as well. I think there's been some really amazing research on like the disproportionate share of immigrants that are entrepreneurs. And so the extent that we attract those types of people, I think that's got to be great for growth, productivity, and so on. Hopefully we continue to do that. Yes, they're not equally representative of the population. There are females. So, you know, I told the story of Nancy Muller, the like quiche maven. There's another one, like a travel center, a couple that started sort of, they sell truck stop. They did a bunch of truck stops where like you get gas if you're a trucker and then you go in and take a shower and get food and stuff called Loves. And it was like a husband wife where they each were playing a role in the business and that kind of thing. So there are a lot of those kinds of stories. There are fewer female entrepreneurs in the data. Those gaps have not closed very dramatically over time. It's an interesting challenge. It's interesting to think about what's the nature of the entrepreneurial job that makes it harder for women to enter or grow businesses, except in some sectors. Maybe they're greedy jobs, which I think, you know, Claudia Golden has an interesting book on greedy jobs, jobs that like make families. There's flexibility, but it's also like these people are on all the time. So I think that's quite interesting. There's still room to close gaps in the data, but I think the SAT graph that I showed is also giving a lot of opportunity and hope. So I like that as a counter to the fact that clearly there are some persistent disparities. We want to understand them.
Great. Thanks. So we're into our last round of questions, and they're going to need to be reasonably concise questions as well, please. So I think those of you who have braved the tube strikes and the rain to be here are going to get priority in this round. So I'm going to take three from our in-person audience, starting with the gentleman in the white T-shirt there in the third row.
Thank you. I'm a Year 12 student. I go to Langley Park School for Boys, and my questions are related to what the chair first asked. And I'm wondering, the chair sort of said in the media, it really flies under the radar, these Main Street millionaires. And I was wondering, what do you think the most effective way of increasing awareness about this issue is? And do you think it's an issue that sort of the everyday person needs to know? Or is it something that should be left to specialists to deal with in their own way? Or And yeah, if it is a problem that everyone needs to know, then how do you think you can increase awareness of it?
Great. Just right behind, Roback.
Awesome. Hi. Great presentation. My name is Max. I'm an Atlantic Fellow at the International Inequalities Institute. And my question is around, is if there's any like statistically significant difference in some of the indicators of power between owners and labor? The slide you had was really interesting about the share of labor has declined over time. So wondering things like unionization rates in these firms, things like full-time benefits, full-time contracts, things like the ratio between the highest paid employee to the lowest paid employee, are those statistically significantly different than maybe Fortune 500 or much smaller SME type businesses? Thanks.
Okay, and last question to the gentleman at the back in the red, please.
Hi, I'm Shekhar Dadlani. I'm just a layperson. Thank you for the presentation. I had a quick question, and it's in continuation of what you mentioned earlier about is there a longitudinal study or something that you looked into or your team looked into which compares the incumbent trying to build these tax kind of moat around themselves, reducing innovation over time in those industries versus had those tax advantages not been in place, would innovation have been faster?
Yeah, so I'll try to also answer shortly because I'm realizing I'm short on time. Ways to raise awareness of this group, you know, write a book and talk your head off about it, I guess, as kind of the answer. You know, I do think like the narrative component of the book and like a little bit of the entertainment value of the book with some of the funniness of some of these stories is meant to capture, right, like people's attention in a way. Do I think the general lay people, I think the like lay audience, everybody has an opinion about inequality and is concerned about it and its effects. And there's also folks who like, you know, aspire to financial success. And so I think recognizing where it comes from, who it is, right? So then if you want to reduce inequality, like after tax inequality, you know, a really high threshold billionaire tax will affect a very small slice of it. You know, maybe it's an important thing to do, but it's not the only thing that we should be thinking about if you want to address the inequality question. If you, you know, aspire to financial success, which is not necessarily, some people do, some people don't, tech and finance are not the only ways to do it. Learning a trade and then continuing to grow and take some risk at slow and steady way. There are a lot of success stories along that path, and it's kind of interesting to think about. These people are really passionate about what they're doing, if it like looks boring from the outside. And so I do think it's important to recognize what a grind it would be if you didn't enjoy being that quiche manufacturer. You know what I mean? So on workers at these businesses versus at large businesses, I mean, a pretty important one is healthcare. So again, like at a large, multinational or like a large employer now, you know, has economies of scale such that they can offer health insurance by pooling among all those workers at a cost advantageous way relative to small businesses. This affects the labor pool that like wants to go work at some of these firms. So I think like the way we provide that benefit specifically in society is just increasingly distorting labor supply in ways that are like kind of unhelpful. It also maybe creates some power like for those, you know, firm owners, if they want to hire workers, they offer those benefits. They're willing to pay quite low wages for workers who really will really demand or want those benefits, that kind of thing. I don't know if there's greater pay disparity between the top and bottom workers within these firms. I don't think there's huge differences there necessarily. They're less likely to provide incentive pay at the top than I think larger companies are with stock and, you know, profit sharing type arrangements. We suggest that, you know, some of these owners might benefit from providing a little bit more rent sharing, incentivized rent sharing to their workers, but they're like, you know, maybe historically conservative, preserving ownership and being very secretive about the nature of the business. And it's an interesting question that we try and explore a bit. Would the absence of tax preferences have changed the competitive position of these businesses? I'm not so sure. It seems like the local market regulations, the way they've lobbied for protections, is kind of like a separate part of it. But then once you have those protections, how much you get to keep of the rents that, that those protections create, the tax rules do matter there. It's interesting to think if they are rents, then increasing the tax on them isn't going to affect effort or activity there. But another policy you might prefer is to promote entry or promote more competition in those industries. That would benefit consumers, maybe increase labor demand, benefit workers, you know, at the expense of some of these like incumbents. And I think in some of these industries, it's pretty important to look at that. Yeah.
Great. We are right out of time, unfortunately, and it's, I think it's testament to the provocation of the book that there were many more questions we could have got to, so apologies to those who missed out. But so Eric's book is on sale from September, but as he reminded you earlier, you can click now to commit to purchasing one, and I strongly recommend that you do. It's been great, and I look forward to reading the whole thing end to end when it's out. Thank you very much again to Eric, and have a good evening all.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.